This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, May 11th, 2013, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Dr. Frederick Tobin. His website is tobin.biz. That's B-I-Z. It's in a state of construction at the moment, but I'm sure that there will be plenty of very, very wonderful things there soon. He is the author of several articles and also a very important book. Could you pronounce that?
Arbeit macht frei.
Yes, that's it. Impertinent Incarceration. And your other book is called? You have another book?
40 Days in Tehran. And then also 50 Days in Jail.
Yes.
And then another one, Where Truth Is No Defense, I Want to Break Free. And the rather large one, Fight or Flight, or is it flight or fight? I don't know. I forget these things. The Personal Face of Revisionism, it's about 700 pages, and that one is online. I still don't remember how it ever got online. Someone put it on, and it's gone viral, so to speak. It's a nice kind of summary of my running around the world and looking up revisionists and others to see what makes them tick.
Okay.
As you know, yeah.
Now, where might people find this online?
If you put that fight or flight in a search engine, I think then it does come up. A couple of sites are carrying it.
Okay.
It's an electronic download.
Perfect. All righty. And the website that you use a lot and that used to be yours, it's adelaideinstitute.org. And you have a newsletter that you produce, that the Institute produces.
Yes.
On a very frequent basis. And the one for May is number 692. And you've covered so many things, my goodness gracious, including the Boston Marathon bombing. And you compare it to some terrorist activities there in your own country.
That is the contentious issue. I hesitate to get into a kind of conspiratorial mindset unless I have proof thereof, but just like with 9/11, we know it's an insider job, but then the immediate question is, well, who do you think did it? Well, the proof isn't there. We just haven't got the proof. And the same thing, unless we accept as proof the official version, the official conspiracy theory, which is that a group of Arabic-speaking individuals did the job, which is highly unlikely. And that, Deanna, is interesting for me because, remember, when it happened, the narrative was developed very quickly. Within hours, we knew the names of all the individuals who allegedly were involved in this. And since that time, especially last year and this year, with the shootings at the school, I remember the president coming out and saying, oh, we don't quite know what's happened. In other words, they have tapped in onto the or into the general feeling that what is called or what is then billed as the official story of what happened, the official narrative, is being questioned by the people, by the Americans. So they're hesitating. And I noticed that at the Boston Marathon bombing, this initially there was a bit of a hesitation, but then very quickly the narrative sealed the deal that it was two Chechens who had come to America, who were dissatisfied with what was going on, and they took revenge by having this or plotting this terrorist bombing incident.
Right. And then they said also that they were going to, they had another target, but they just, of course, didn't get to that other target yet. Amazing stuff.
And it's interesting that it was Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, who said, oh, yes, they were also coming for us.
Right. We have to get New York in there, and we have to involve Bloomberg, don't we?
Yes.
And of course, he spreads his money around quite readily and willingly to affect other areas of the country and their legislation. He backed one of the senators, one of the representatives that was running here, sent her millions of dollars so that she could win. I'm thinking, you know, it's bad enough that he's running New York. He ought to just stay out of Illinois. We have our own problems with Rahm Emanuel.
Yes. I mean, it's amazing how he got in. So when I hear that the Americans, and especially Wolfowitz, Paul Wolfowitz, is angry at Anwar Ibrahim not winning the Malaysian election, then I just wonder, perhaps it's too easy in America to fiddle the books and win elections. And so they're rather angry that they can't do it in via proxy in another country.
Right.
And this, of course, subverts the actual democratic process, where if we still believe in a democracy, as you still have it in America with the First Amendment, because once it goes, and I've mentioned this before, that if you lose that concept of free expression in America, then, well, that's the end of it. Then we may as well, or you may as well, lock down and become like the former Soviet Union, or especially like the East Germans, submit and just close down.
Well, I wonder if we haven't already lost free expression simply because we don't have any representation in the media, and therefore we are silenced, and the only way that we can indicate our feelings or ask questions is on the internet. And even there, we have so many infiltrators in the various chat rooms and in the various forums that when we do speak out, there's 50 or 100 people criticizing what we're saying. So it's free expression. It just exists just on paper as the First Amendment and very few other places.
Yes, I noticed when American tourists came to Adelaide, they would be noisy. I noticed this in Europe. The American tourists were a noisy lot. In Spain, in Madrid, I visited the Prado, I think it is, and we had this group of Americans. I saw it was about half a dozen women. And I was walking behind them, and I thought, gee, you know, short skirts and lively chatter. I thought this be well. I was a young man, and I like that visual representation that I saw before me. So I quickened my pace, and then I turned around, and these women looked like scarecrows. They were all 60. They were all 60 plus, and I thought, what on earth are they giggling about, and so on. And I just noticed that, you know, this fear of growing old is so, well, it's a deception. In America, the beauty quest of having a facelift, of doing this and trying to look younger, of combating growing old, is a tragedy. I'm just, well, this year, just 1 year off 70, and I'm rather pleased that I don't have to go through the rubbish that my son, who's 30-something, that he still has to go through. And so I could never understand that. But I was thinking of another example. After 9/11, we had a group of American tourists in Adelaide going to Mount Lofty to the summit. There's a lovely hilltop where visitors go, and they have a lovely view of Adelaide and the sea beyond Adelaide. It's a lovely view. You can have a nice cup of coffee there, some refreshments and so on. And this group of about 35, they'd come in by one of these luxury liners. They were very, very quiet, subdued. It just wasn't the way it was before 9/11. So in this respect, that incident has perhaps brought America into maturity by forcing them to reflect a little more on things. But unfortunately, because it's an artificial incident that has had the effect on the people, silencing them and bringing in that reflective energy, unfortunately, it's based on fear and a false fear. And that is the sadness. And this is then when individuals believe in rubbish, when individuals are forced by the power of legal sanctions to give up that spontaneity that they initially had, that almost that innocence, that childlike element that we should still, well, should perhaps retain till our dying days, where that freshness is there, where we can perceive things, where we are not forced into silence through fear, and often self-inflicted fear, then you know, what creative impulse can come out of that kind of mindset?
Exactly. It's a very, very sad thing. There is still a lot of ignorance, but the people who accept the official version of what is going on are afraid of the wrong thing. They do have fear, but they fear something that's external, when in fact they should fear the government. And not, I hate to even say that we should fear the government, because the minute they understand and acknowledge that the population is afraid of them, then that gives them more power. And so I don't like to say that I'm afraid of the government. I believe that we should defend ourselves against the government with force if necessary.
Yes. Now, that is the problem with force. Once I hear that, and I was on Dennis Fatcho's program where he said the same thing, and I would have to put in the caveat that this is not as far as I would go, because this is what they're looking for in order to nail me down.
Oh, because exactly.
If I say, yes, force, then I've had it with my track record.
Right. I'm speaking generally.
I know how you feel, because, I'll bring in Gordon Duff and his veterans today just to illustrate the point. Although he admitted that most of 40% of his stuff is fabricated and so on.
Exactly. It's amazing that he would make such an admission.
No, Gordon is honest. He's honest.
He's an honest liar, right?
Yeah, indeed.
He's honest about his lies.
Yes, yes. But what I like about it is, and this is what we're trying to do in Australia, is we're trying to engage with the bureaucracy that is the government. want to, because in the bureaucracy of the services, military and non-military, there are individuals, and as Duff said, who can't take the shit anymore. Mm-hmm. And this is what we've got to tap in, not blanket condemn, and you qualified yourself there, not blanket condemn the so-called government, because as one smart fellow, we had this exchange on the emails, and he said, oh, I went to Washington and I looked for the government, and all I found was people and buildings.
Indeed.
In other words, it's a mental construct. So as soon as we talk about these things, we get into interpretation, and we have to see what's going on. And that's what I like about individuals who dare then break through. For my current example is, of course, John Kaminsky, who appeared on the Fetch's program, and then Fetch was booted off, so allegedly off his network, because right. Kaminsky always uses the term Jew. And
but
for me,
it's better than some other words that they could be called.
Oh, yes. I mean, what was it? He was on the Renz program, apparently. Archons, they call them Archons, A-R-C-H-O-N-S, which is the Greek for ruler or lord.
Ah.
In other words, another cover, or, you know, like in if anyone's interested in opera and Wagner's operas, we have the Nibelung. And many individuals say, well, you know, this is it's a synonym for the Jews. Once we reach that point of covering up or using a different name, they're like the Archons or so, I would agree with John Kaminsky and simply say that's nonsense. Let's name the name. These individuals who are pushing a certain line are of the Jewish faith. If not of the Jewish faith, then certainly they self-identify with that kind of mindset. But then my old maxim, don't only blame the Jews, blame those that bend to their pressure, I think is important, because by what John does, everything that's wrong is the Jews. Well, that's the flip side of the official narrative of events, so for example, at 9/11, that it's the Muslims.
Right.
You can't do that. It's too simplistic. And I sense that now this is why I was fascinated with the Boston Marathon bombing, because it was made clear the so-called individuals who are running the enterprise, and there are many from different backgrounds, all different backgrounds, they expose one item when the Hadassah hospital in Jerusalem sent experts to Boston, to the Beth Israel Boston hotel. Why am I saying hotel?
Actually, hotels are a lot cheaper.
I think I need a drink, but I don't.
It's too early in the morning there.
Oh, yes.
But the hospital, yes, they sent these experts, and I'm thinking, well, my goodness, we don't have any medical experts here in this country that could take care of some of these victims, so-called victims.
Exactly, Deanna. This is the point. You just wonder why they had to come, and of course, it fits into that extension of broadening that narrative, bringing in Israel. And how they suffered at the hands of the Palestinian suicide bombers, or freedom fighters, I would rather call them, doing their business.
Right. Well, it certainly, there have been so many pictures of Boston. The particularly one that is very significant is the fellow in the wheelchair. And then we know that that some of these operations that FEMA hires actors, and there's actually a website that has actors who have disabilities, limbless actors, who are perfectly willing to participate in these exercises. And what is very interesting about most of these false flag attacks, these false flag events, is that there's always an exercise, some sort of government exercise going on at the same time, which people seem to know about.
This bothers me that it's so blatant.
Yes.
For example, this is what Captain Eric May used to focus on. He had his network of individuals all over America. And whenever anyone noticed, you know, from the West Coast to the East Coast, if there was an exercise going on, they would observe it. They would have them there. So if it actually went live, then this extra knowledge was there that there was an exercise going on.
I think the tribe has always been kind of blatant. They've certainly published plenty of information, plenty of a forecast, if you will, about what they intend to do. And then when we point out, well, yes, it's right here in the protocols, or it's right there in some book.
Anti-Semite.
Yes, then we're an anti-Semite. They get us coming and going, don't they?
Yeah. This is what I noticed this time with the Boston bombing, that I think Hollywood's going to be out of a job. Because they don't need Hollywood anymore. We are now watching reality TV as it is being made. You can see it is actually all following a script. The script writers are now politicians, or the behind the scene. You know, 20, even 30, 40 years ago, politicians, certainly in Australia, they wrote their own speeches and they would work out these things themselves. Now, we don't have many journalists anymore because the newspaper, the physical, the hard copy newspapers are closing down. But what we've got is a team of journalists who are flocking around politicians. Each politician has to have so many advisors, and they're the ones who write the script. And they don't, the actual politician has to be just a good actor. So Hollywood's come, it's become universal.
Right. I don't know whether Ronald Reagan started that particular thing, but they don't even write any bills anymore. They have organizations that write all the bills, and they have speech writers to write their talks. And it kind of makes you wonder, well, exactly what are they supposed to be doing? Just doing PR work and acting out, acting like politicians that are supposed to be representing us? That seems to be what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a movie set.
Mm-hmm.
It's in reality, you know, this is how I see the thing at the moment. That it's and through the internet, of course, there is a filtering system that enables individuals who are still thinking independently, who are still not paralyzed by this fear, that these individuals need to be shut down, closed down as well.
Right. Yes. And that's been happening because I have always said that prior to 9/11, and I'm certain prior to any big event, there's already a group of people in place that are going to be infiltrating the so-called truth movement in order to present not the government's version, but their own kind of version to keep people from really nailing the truth. And I think that was very true with 9/11, that people were in place that because they knew there would be skeptics. The government knew that there would be a group of people who would say, now, wait a minute, that just could not happen. You can't run a plane into a steel building. A steel building does not fall down like that. And so they had people in place to say, oh yes, it was thermite, it was thermate, it was bombs, it was this, it was that. And all the while to hide what it actually really was, which was something that probably none of us really envisioned. But we do have to realize that the government has a lot of technology that we have no clue about.
Yeah, and this mechanism of conceding that the truth movement is getting closer to the truth, but then still diverting. We had this with, and this is where the Boston Marathon bombing comes in again, in my instance, my looking at the situation. I think what I'm predicting now, as I said, in the newsletter, I do it in the spirit of how Captain Eric May did it in America. For the former Prime Minister, John Howard, just this year, it's the New York Times or Post, which one belongs to the Moonies?
The Washington Post.
Washington, I think, yeah, Washington, yeah. Anyway, one of these papers, he said he got, he succeeded in getting control of the guns in Australia. Now, by having a scheme of buyback. Well,
right.
we've topped the 23 million in population. That's hardly anything. And so up to a point, this is possible. It did work up to a point. But I've been informed that there are many, many weapons that are now resting beneath the ground, as in America. And in other words, there are individuals in Australia who are not going to give up living without a physical fight. But back to the Boston bombing, let me just make this comment about the Jerusalem connection and going to Boston. And these Jews who came as medicos and worked at the Boston scene, they have also a connection with Australia. Now, in 2001, I think up to 2007, a German-born doctor, Thomas Kossmann, he was in charge of the trauma unit at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. He was actually celebrated as a wonderful doctor. He ran the department in typical German efficiency. And then suddenly in 2007, he wasn't good enough anymore. And they processed him, or they proceeded against him by activating the Ombudsman's Office, which then wrote a condemning report about his competence. Now, unfortunately or fortunately, this kind of process I've been subjected to, I know how it works. You cannot defend yourself against that. He did, I think, about 800-page responses and so on, nothing. The ombudsman condemned his efficiency, also linking it to his criminal activity by overbilling and all sorts of things like that. And the ombudsman's office then suggested that the police get involved, the taxation office, you know, the other agencies that usually then finish you off.
Sure.
Well, he has succeeded in fending everything off. No police investigation, no taxation matter. But they came to a settlement about 3-4 years later. And he's now doing other things. But the important thing was that the then health minister, Nicola Roxon, who claims to be Jewish, she had and she announced that the hospital in Jerusalem, the trauma unit of the Hasada, I think it was Hasada hospital, was now going to link with the Alfred's trauma unit, and they were going to do something. Now, that happened in 2008, I think, around that time, and the Boston bombing happened this year, I'm now predicting that because they've got these pliable people, these people who will go along with that kind of setup, that something may happen in Melbourne, perhaps at a football match, but certainly the parallels are there with the 1996 Port Arthur massacre, where this alleged lone gunman shot 30-plus people and injured many more. And this man, Martin Bryant, was also mentally handicapped. So he was a good shot. Vietnam veterans tell me that not even a snap marksman could do it. It had to be a team. Now, once the Port Arthur massacre occurred, it was on a Sunday. On that same weekend, there was a medical congress taking place in Hobart, just a little away from, a little distance away from the Port Arthur site, the tourist site, where on that weekend, an American group of tourists were on a bus. They were about to go to the Island of the Dead, the cemetery for this penal colony establishment, Port Arthur, and they were late in boarding the boat. And this is where the whole episode of Port Arthur went wrong, because the delay in shipping the American tourists across, and it was said that the aim was to eliminate them, because at that time Clinton wanted an excuse to ban the guns, very much like the Boston thing. And so that went wrong, and then, well, the people had to reconfigure. There was one scene in the cafe where an operative was in there, and one survivor heard him call out as another one came in with a gun. He's saying, "Not in here." Well, that operative also died.
Oh, yes.
And was shot. Mm-hmm. What I'm getting at is that Joe Viles used to do all sorts of things from Western Australia. He then died, and we don't know whether he was real or not, but it didn't matter. He put out a little brochure on the Port Arthur massacre, and people devoured it. It was the best underground seller. It did well. And people were at the same time pushing for an inquiry, opening it up, very much like this 9/11 thing. And the prediction was then already that if that is to be the case, if there was another hearing, an opening of the whole proceedings, because, you know, there were no autopsy on these overseas visitors who died, and that's unusual. Then, for example, there was no gathering of physical evidence, like in the restaurant where allegedly Bryant sat. There was a Coke can and other items. They could have been forensically investigated for fingerprints and things like that. All this was not done. It was all closed down. And so if there is another inquiry, the people confronting or coming up would all be basing their information on the Joe Viles thing.
Right. And of course, that's with everything, with all of the false flags. They get rid of the evidence without ever having an independent study on it. Whether you're talking about 9/11, whether you're talking about Sandy Hook, whether you're talking about the Boston event, or in Port Arthur.
Yes, and Port Arthur. You know what they do. The argument is always the same. You have so many witnesses to this and survivors. And this always reminds me of Holocaust survivors. They are so traumatized by this, so the evidence quickly has to be disappeared because it could upset someone else.
Right.
And that, of course, is total fraud. I always muse to myself when I see a real crime scene, the way police meticulously cordon it off. And they really then go into the physical details of it, and they'll establish the physical evidence. But this is what Ryle's police generally, even in America, when it's an insider job, the ordinary fellow in the street, the ordinary police who is actually doing security work, they are sidelined they are then advised by the higher up to make way for the FBI, to make way for the CIA, to make way for all the other agencies, who then secure the scene and fiddle the books. And right. That's sad.
Well, that the same when you're even when you're discussing the JFK assassination, it should have been up to the Dallas Police Department to kind of come in and take over, but that didn't happen there, and certainly has not happened anywhere else that I can think of.
Yep, and this is where we have to tap into the ordinary people who actually are on the ground, the so-called first responders, and. While I'm talking about this, I met a fellow. I was flying to Sydney or Brisbane, and I met a fellow on the plane. His cousin lives in outback South Australia, and her husband died in the 9/11, and she got a $1 million something payout. I didn't know that this was happening.
They paid out $1 million to each of the survivors' families, providing they wouldn't ask any more questions and would just keep their mouth shut. And there are some people, particularly a widow whose name I can't think of right now, who will not. She has filed suit, and she has a lawyer, I believe, in Pennsylvania that is working in her behalf. But she is not going to go away quietly because she did not accept the $1 million. And of course, when you consider that the $1 million is taxpayer funded, I mean, because the government certainly doesn't produce anything or have it, they get it all from the working people of America. So when you consider the ramifications of that, it's kind of interesting that we are paying people to not ask questions.
Yeah, I think that lady, didn't she attend the Barnes Review conference in 2006?
Because
I know when I caught my flight back, she was at the airport as well, and there was some kind of flight delay, and you know she just didn't like that, and she made a bit of a scene. But I thought it was excellent. She is not going to keep quiet. Unless, of course, you know, she has to have an accident if she goes too far.
Right. Her name is Ellen Mariani.
That's it. Yes, I think that's the one.
And interestingly, I believe that Bruce Lichty, may be representing her.
Uh-huh, yes.
So he's not in Pennsylvania, but... yeah, I think
isn't he somewhere on the West Coast?
Yes, Lichty is how you pronounce his name, but I think and it was her husband Louis Neil Mariani, who was on Flight 175, and he is currently representing her.
Yeah. Well, these are all the deceptions, you know, and it interests me how. The individuals who bend to this pressure, who recant, and then turn up again, as we have the example of David Cole.
Oh yes, that's very interesting too.
And it again, it's interesting how for 20 odd years he's done other things, and he reinvented himself. And I had sympathy for him doing that. I remember when I raised the matter in 2000 during one of my talks in Sydney, where I read out the statement that the ADL had written out for him, which he then reproduced. And I just thought, gee, that is a problem, because... if you've done the work, and his great work was in getting the admission from František Pípa, the curator at the Auschwitz Museum, that Kremer 1 is a reconstruction, as Forreston had discovered much earlier. It was a rebuilding of something. The chimney was not attached to the crematorium, and all sorts of things. In other words, the physical reality didn't match the narrative that was fed to all those visitors, and still is. I was informed that Crema One, then in 96, what's his name, Van Pelt and Deborah Dwork, in their book Auschwitz from 1270 to the Present, they admitted that it was a reconstruction, that it was symbolically to represent what actually happened at Auschwitz-Birkenau or Crema Two.
Which is so silly to symbolically represent. Well, why don't you just use the regular representative building if it was actually there? Just you don't need to create something to represent something.
Now, the story keeps on changing. That's the old thing. The story keeps on changing, and now we're on this Holocaust business. I worried a bit that Cole is back. Because once you recant like that, I don't know whether you can find your way back again. It's like telling a lie and then saying, oh, look, I did that. The German word is Notlüge, you know, a sort of a forced lie to save your life.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose why the communist system in East Germany or Eastern Europe, in the Soviet Union, and even the communist system in North Korea or China would at the very top twist people and get them away from natural processes, from a disconnect from nature, because it's a rational system that puts human nature above everything. It does not embed human nature within nature. And that's the sadness of it. That's the deception that I think is having these ugly outgrowths that come through, where we believe we can do anything, we can be anything. Where we have if only we have the freedom to do all this.
Right. But that is something that David Cole did when he went to Auschwitz and he talked to the director there of the museum. He did something that a non-Jew could not possibly do. And because of his innocence, his age, and his rhetorical skill, he was able to win the trust of that man, so that man would divulge something that he probably would never have divulged to anybody else.
Yeah, that's a very important point, Deanna, that he managed to weasel that out, using the weasel word. And that's the sadness of it, that we are excluded from the process of discovering truth.
Yes.
And you have the you know, there are plenty of examples of that. For example, the Treblinka last year, the archaeologist Caroline, what was her name? Sturdy.
Oh, Cole, right, right.
From the University of Birmingham. She went to Treblinka and she revealed the hidden graves of the Holocaust. Now, Richard Craigie, while I was in jail in Germany in 1999, Richard Craigie went up to Treblinka and he did the GP, ground penetrating radar. I must say ground penetrating radar, not GPS. We're onto the wrong systems. But he actually pioneered that method as a Holocaust scholar, but he could not follow it up because his career is at stake if he does. Now, that's the sadness of it, which then also, of course, hit David Cole when he made that revelation public. It had consequences. And he, as a young man, and I think I said this on Caroline Yeager's program, had I not been alone in the last 20 years, had I had to make concessions to a wife and family, then I don't think I would be as resolute to pursue the truth, because the threats are great and they're real.
Right.
Yes.
Right. We see what. Right. We see what. We so see I what have, happens to other people, and we don't want that to happen to us. We don't want our careers destroyed, and we don't want our family threatened, or perhaps even worse. And so we are reticent to speak out.
Yeah, and you accommodate, and what's not happening in America at the moment, and that should happen, is where the comedians pick up this dissonance, where they pick up this element, as they did in East Germany, and a lot of humor developed, black humor, so to speak. And that hasn't quite happened in America. There's still that innocence, that sort of seriousness, at the same time the total superficiality of it all. For example, wasn't it one fellow was taking photos on in Pan Am or one of these airlines, and he was chucked off because he endangered security or something like that. He was told to switch off, and he did, but that wasn't enough. He then confronted the pilots afterwards, or something happened. So, you know, the climate of fear is crippling ordinary relationships. And that's the sadness, because the trust is gone now, even among the various agencies that are competing with one another, the individuals running them. There's no more trust. I just don't. Well, there's not a commonality that unites them. It's now dog eat dog, and that's sad. This great American enterprise, for me, it's the ideal that you have freedom of expression enshrined, because once you cannot speak openly anymore, then all you do is either shut up and wither away, or start lying and fabricating and distorting, and then you're in la-la land. You need Prozac or something. Oh, that reminds me of the joke. I also have to mention that when I first came to America investigate meet the revisionists there, I said, you know, America's a very quiet country. It's very nice. People are polite. In checkouts and in supermarkets and so on. Well, now it's almost automatic. It's just by machine. But when at that time in the 80s and so on, it wasn't. And you'd have people saying, you're welcome and thank you. And the politeness was wonderful. And one fellow said, you think that's real? I said, yes. No, it's not. It's because the men have got their weapon in their pocket and women are on Prozac.
Oh, hopefully that's not true.
Well, but this is the problem now when you have in the population, the medical system going berserk in forcing parents who can't cope with their children to let their children be labeled as attention deficiency syndrome. Now, kids are kids. The Germans have a concept, Sturm und Drang, storm and stress. It's a normal thing for individuals to be rebellious. If they're not, there's something wrong with them. As some, which David Brocksmith once said, the Marxists used to say this, those who grew out of Marxism, they would say, if you're not a Marxist at 21, you haven't got a heart. If you're still a Marxist at 50 or so, you haven't got a head. In other words, the concept of maturity is an extremely important one. At the moment, your president is pushing the line of we must change. But people don't change. They don't change. They develop like any natural organic thing like a flower. You mature, you unfold, and then the petals drop. And that also happens to us. We spend an inordinate time in trying to say that there is such a thing as transcendence, that, you know, there is an afterlife, we want to believe in it, and so on. And that, I noticed, the so-called atheists, they ballyhoo that kind of endeavor, which is very comforting, which is an important part of our life, to find that transcendence. But they then move to the other line and say, oh, it was UFOs who did it. So the atheist who believes in nothing but rationality, coming out of the French Revolution with that nonsense that everything is supposed to be rational, but as we know, life is more than just logic. And so they move into the UFO, where then I remember one fellow, he showed me a video of Central Australia. He said there were the UFOs had just landed, which he had taken a video of in the 80s. And all I could see on the screen was a light dot flickering and moving back and forth. And all the time with the UFOs, it's always a hazy, shady, dark, whatever. And I'll believe in UFOs as if I can put my hand on one and say, this is it.
Right.
I hope I haven't upset you.
Oh, no, I don't. I think we have enough on this earth to worry about without worrying about UFOs. I rather keep everything in a terrestrial kind of on a terrestrial level.
Yes. But then we must go into the arts. I think this is this transcendence kind of thing where we develop that creative impulse, where we actually do create newness, where we become anticipatory, where we can see where the trend is going. And this is where the internet has enabled individuals to speculate and to think about it. And it worries me, for example, notice I've got lots of worries. In November, December in Melbourne, we've got the Wagner Ring. We had it in 98 in Adelaide and in 2004. And now the third time in Australia, the full ring in Melbourne. And it'll be interesting because what we've got with Wagner, of course, is the connection with Adolf Hitler.
Right.
In Berlin, in Cologne, I think it was, they put on Tannhäuser, and the people, the singers, they were all dressed in uniform, SS uniform and whatever, and they actually turned that opera into a Holocaust thing. They depicted death in gas chambers.
Yeah, isn't that a terrible thing? Wasn't it awful?
Yeah, rape and all those things. And people started booing and running out. And then there were individuals who were so shocked they needed medical attention.
Oh, my goodness.
This is what happened just recently in May, in Germany, where the people, for example, we had Australian Barry Kosky in 96. He conducted he directed the Flying Dutchman in Sydney, and they were all dressed in Nazi uniforms. And luckily, one of the critics, she pointed out that was a horrible production, but luckily, she said, the music saved the night. In other words, Wagner's music is so powerful, it's so elementary and so prophetic that what you saw visually was switched off by the music. And that for me is an important point, that with Wagner, anyone, I know individuals say, oh, Wagner's terrible. Then my response now is, and it's a new response, I say, well, you're not a German. Wagner's music is universal, but certainly It touches the German soul. And of course, by linking that demanding music to the National Socialists and its current narrative, the official narrative of the of Auschwitz and so on, the Holocaust, linking it to the Holocaust, of course, tries to belittle it. And I can predict that they will not knock it out. And of course, we in 96, we also had our revisionist conference in Adelaide, where Andrew Gray, and he's passed away, so peace be upon him. He was a Wagner expert. His translation of Wagner's autobiography, My Life, is still current. And he gave a very nice talk about the importance of Wagner and the individuals who he belittled, justifiably, who tried to link it to Hitler and the alleged Holocaust. So that, for me, was interesting because it brings in the concept of the dialectic. And you know, this is my little hobby horse. When we have the win-lose, when we have the reality shows that are allegedly so popular, where individuals compete and win and lose, and the losers are then shamed as well, and they let themselves be shamed, where this kind of thing rests on a Marxist dialectic of thinking of win-lose. And the Marxistic dialectic, of course, is a Talmudic dialectic, and the problem with that is that it's a win-lose, and in visually it's represented in the class war, class thinking, where individuals self-destruct if they're not destructed by the opposition. It distorts. It does not account for a civilization at its best. And you can see how the communist system degenerated economically. And even in North Korea, I mean, it's sad to see how that is fading because it's not productive. The real dialectic, and unfortunately the Christians in America have been inculcated with the idea that this is a bad one, but it's the Hegelian dialectic. We all use it, and we have a number of different thought methods. This is one of them, where you have the win-win, the dialectic, where you have the thesis, for example, the man, then the antithesis or antithesis, the woman, and the opposites come together, not in a life-death struggle like in Marxism, but in a procreative way, man and woman come together, and the synthesis is the child, 50% from both, where the opposite come together and produce something new. Now, in culture, in economics, all this was the idea of the sort of the National Socialist element, where we the element the of creating a new kind of world, of disconnecting from a parasitic element, was developed. Are we over time?
No. I was just thinking about this, and when you say the man and the woman come together, and then when you look at what is going on in this country and in other countries also, where you have same-sex marriage, and which produces nothing except a kind of a lifestyle and acceptance, well, where people are accepting it legally or where the law is changing it, and people are accepting this. Wow, that's just a very interesting thought. And
yeah, it's an ultimate, the same-sex thing, although some want to ape the ordinary family. What's happening is that this is a kind of nihilism. It's a kind of hedonism that self-destructs. And all you can do is have a good time, enjoy yourself, and if you've got the money, go on another cruise and feel sorry, be a bleeding heart and feel sorry for the poor people, increase overseas aid for all those who are being exploited by our capitalist system, but feel sorry for them and relieve them, but still make them dependent on...
Right.
And, for example, you know, apartheid disappeared or colonialism disappeared in Africa, but the new colonialism is there.
Sure. And
the only one who really tried hard to hold out was Robert Mugabe, the Marxist, who became in Zimbabwe, who became a nationalist, but then realized it was just too great, and you know they printed their money and it was into the trillions or millions, and the notes were. So now it's the dollar, the US dollar rules. And I then have to laugh at myself because North Korea officially, well, unofficially, but prints the hot dollars. They've got original plates there, so I believe. And when you're overseas and in some countries where you then get the brand new notes, where this country then doesn't have a relationship with America, you wonder, where did they get them from?
Well, I wonder. I guess the same place where that Russia, the Soviet Union, got theirs.
Indeed. This is, you know, that's where I then laugh to myself and say, goodness me, is this, are we really in the real world, or is this cloud cuckoo land?
Is this
And what can you do then? Once you reach that point, are you going to get angry like John Kaminsky and get more ulcers, or are you just going to continue and throw in your lot with them and go down drinking away or drugging away your life, or are you going to hold the line?
Well, I think, you know, you brought up medication and how they want to have all of these children in school more manageable by giving them Ritalin or whatever. And I think they do the same thing with the adult population. They want everybody to be on medication. It's not only very, very profitable for the pharmaceutical industry, but it also keeps people very dependent. They're dependent on their doctors. They're dependent on getting up in the morning and going and popping some pills. And so you have a drugged up society, whether it's, you know, mostly from pharmaceutical drugs, and they're simply not paying any attention. And as far as getting angry, I think that you can know what's going on. You can be very saddened by it, but I don't think that getting angry about it is very helpful, because I think it can be self-destructive.
Very true, very true. If I look back on my life, what I've been through in the last 20 years, had I become angry, I wouldn't have been able to laugh at myself anymore when I do silly things, like forgetting where I put my keys and things like that.
Sure.
But only a few weeks ago, I was in Adelaide, Grenfell Street, walking along to an office. And I passed a pedestrian crossing, which was red for the pedestrians trying to get across. And I passed this man, little fellow like me, and I thought, I know that fellow. So I stopped, put out my hand, and said, "Congratulations, sir." And the fellow said, "Oh, thank you." And he held out his hand. We shook hands, and then I went on my way. Now, that man put me in prison for 3 months. He was the judge, Judge Bruce Lander, and he had just been appointed to head the anti-crime or the ICAC, Independent Commission Against Crime, in South Australia. And so I thought, well, good on him.
Yes.
I didn't feel any animosity towards him, because he is a prisoner himself of that system.
Sure. Sure.
And in time, one hopes he will mature and realize that. Because I still, as a teacher, I hope always, I never gave up on any student, because I know from my own personal development that it's very often slow, that insights do come, though, and in the long run, we all mature. And I wrote one book, When the Innocent Awake. I think we all do this. We've had this at the moment, unfortunately, in a sort of negative, positive way, with the child abuse claims in the Catholic Church and the Jewish community and in the state systems. Australia has set up an inquiry, a royal commission on this. And in some respects, I think it will bring closure to individuals who were suffering, but I have a nagging doubt about individuals who were being abused for 4 or 5 years and then woke up. I can't quite follow that, but there are justifications that no doubt would say, yes, this does happen. But what gets me is at the end, is this idea that they were a victim of someone who did something to them. That, to me, is playing the Holocaust card all over again in a different guise. And you can see how the narrative that is being developed for these child abuse individuals follows very, very closely to this kind of victim mentality that's been almost perfected by those who believe in the Holocaust, not only survivors of the Holocaust, but first and even second generation Holocaust individuals.
Right. And of course, when you're talking about victims of sexual abuse, many of the victims just happen to remember what happened to them right after the person that did it to them has died. And then they seem to have this memory.
But also, as soon as it's as soon as they're informed, there's money in it.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, like with many victims who, not only the sexual element, but other catastrophes, as soon as money comes into it, their victimhood sort of disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is sad, because this is reducing our life to a kind of materialistic existence, which no doubt, I mean, it's a fact. We're in the material world. But that if there's money, all right, I'll forgive you, which is still the case in Asia or in Africa, when I think even now in Afghanistan, where people, if they, the Americans, don't they pay out when they make a mistake in their bombing runs, and then the village gets compensated?
I don't know whether the village gets compensated. As far as I know, a lot of the money that has gone to Afghanistan to rebuild and to do all of these things never actually gets does anything. It does not pay for any reconstruction. It goes into a few pockets, and that's the end of it.
Yeah, again, it doesn't flow where it's needed to lift up the individuals and to get them into a developmental mindset. I mean, I'm always worried when I travel overseas and I see, for example, I will say this, I've never been to India, but during the 80s, the gurus, Bhagwan Rajneesh and so on, he attracted, and Sai Baba and all these types. They attracted a lot of intellectuals from universities who followed their wisdom. Yet not one of these individuals mentioned the fact that, all right, you have this spirituality coming out of India, but then look at the filth around these compounds that are boarded up, that are walled up, that are ghettoized, And this lifestyle does not flow to the general community, into the general community.
Right.
And that I find, again, there is a dissonance. You have this kind of spirituality that leads to ultimate sublimation and, you know, even the Hare Krishna. I remember I was in Honolulu in 1970. On the one side of the street, there was the Hare Krishna singing away Hare Rama and so on. On the other side, there were Bible bashers saying that they were misguided. And, you know, this was our introduction to America for the first time. And you had competing groups selling their message.
Right. Right.
And what are they selling now? The Christian Zionists. What are they selling now?
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I had an occasion this week to be called an anti-Semite, and it was the most amazing thing. The gentleman said, "Well, I can hardly wait until the Jews actually do take control of everything. That will be a most wonderful day." And I'm thinking, my goodness, you think that they are not in control of anything, and that you're waiting for that day when they do? And I'm thinking, my goodness, they control the media, they control Congress, they control Hollywood. What is it that you're waiting for them to take control of? It was just kind of funny.
It's the disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
I was given the same kind of thing. Someone said, "Oh, what you're doing is good, Fred, but gee, you know, don't criticize the Jews. You know, they're God's chosen people." And then, of course, you have the other group, and I worry about this group, although they do go along with the revisionists on matters Holocaust, who call themselves the real Semites. The British Israelites.
Oh, right. Or like the Christian ID people, the CI people, Christian Identity.
And I worry about these people because they are not critical about scientific research. They take the Bible stories literally as proven fact, when in fact scholars have indicated that it is, as some would say, just stories, or even fairy stories from the Middle East, that these stories do not have a mythical truth factor, as, for example, the Greek myths and legends have. If, for example, you dig around Troy and you won't find Helen, but you'll certainly find structures there that confirm some aspects of the mythology that's grown around it. In other words, there is a physical base. The myths and legends can be dug up in bare outline, of course. I mean, you still have to stretch the truth.
Right.
But this is not the case with the Old and the New Testament. Yet there are individuals who trace it right back to the British Isles, and they'll claim that they are the true heirs of God's word. And, I mean, they are the greatest, although they don't accept the official Holocaust narrative, they are the greatest believers. And I had this brought home to me just recently with that Zion Crime Factory fellow,
mm-hmm.
Who would not reveal to me his real name, and that bothered me.
I think that he had a legitimate reason for doing that, because he has been the target of some infiltrators into the so-called truth movement, who have absolutely gone after him with a vengeance. And so he does also live in a country that prosecutes deniers, Holocaust deniers. So I can understand his reticence in not revealing exactly who he is. And
I, yeah, I, I never squabble with him over that, because. But then what happened was he was thrown off his network.
Right.
And that bothered me. The reason. I mean, he made the comparison between an authoritarian mindset that operated also within the Christian identity movement. And, I mean, a little bit of self-criticism doesn't harm. But apparently it was enough for him to be terminated. And I couldn't quite understand that.
I think he was set up to fail. I think that the people who set him up, who helped him to get a website, and he had to do that. He had a website initially, and he kept losing it because people would come along and say, "Oh, this is anti-Semitic. You can't do this." And so somebody came along and said, "Well, hey, I've got my own server. You can have a website on my server." But I think that person deliberately approached him in order to ultimately take him down. So, and then you have to question yourself, well, okay, who hired this guy? Who is this guy working for? What kind of person is he? Because ZCF never made it. He always revealed his beliefs about religion or the lack thereof, and he never kept this hidden. And if somebody had a problem with his lack of belief in Christianity or churchianity or anything like that, he never concealed that. And they shouldn't have approached him to help him develop a website or to host his website if they had a problem with his religion or lack thereof. So, yeah, that was a deliberate taking down of somebody that was very informative, that had a lot of courage, and who did a lot of research, very good research, original research, and presented it very well.
Yeah, I agree with that, and that's why I liked him. I thought he was excellent and young, and you know, this is where the old ones, I can see how this young fellow was bubbling away. He had that freshness that David Cole had.
Exactly.
And if these people, if they're enabled to mature through this bubbly stage, then, you know, they will break this business.
Yes.
Because it's their logic is in this respect then impeccable, because it exposes the not hangers on, but those, as you indicated, those who'd like to then if it gets too close to the core, like to terminate them.
Right. And people like him give one hope, and he did attract a lot of people, and it's just a marvelous thing. And that is just exactly the kind of people that the Jews would like to have silenced.
Yeah, yes.
And so they use non-Jews, but people who are compromised in some area of their life, they use those kinds of people to go in and take these real, real bright, young, fresh truth tellers. They use that kind of person to go in and take them out.
Yeah. And I mean, what's happened to him now? Is he still about?
No. The person took over the website, changed it drastically, took down a lot of the audio files, and he is just pretty much off the scene right now.
They accomplished
their mission, but I have a feeling that he will reemerge even stronger at some point in time.
Well,
because
I hope
he's
so.
He's that kind of person. I don't think that that he's going to not. I don't think he's going to remain silent. He has too much to say and too much courage.
Yeah, and of course this is with maturity. I think this is what also happened to David Cole, and you should get David on the program.
Well, if I could find his email address or his telephone number, that would probably, that's the first thing that I thought of.
Yeah.
Wow, I'd sure like to get him on my program.
Yeah, it's because there's nothing worse than talking about someone. This is what the Jews did in Australia. They never engaged with me. They always did it through an agency, and then only the intention was to silence me. But this, I don't like this, and this is why I undertook these two tours in 97 and 99 to meet the revisionists, and even later on in 2008 and so on, to meet the individuals and to see what they're like. It's interesting. When I met Gordon Duff, I was with Amelia there, and we visited, and yet an impression how sincere someone is. And I could understand from a military point of view what Gordon is trying to achieve, and I agree with that. But then, you know, he had this run-in with Anthony Lawson, and Lawson had his insistence on truth, and others were fiddling the books, or at least on a website you had somebody who was fiddling the books with his within his articles. This upset him. But if you have a website as extensive as Veterans Today is, then, you know, this is the problem. You try to be as universal as possible. We did this when we had our conference in 98. We invited John Sack to come to Australia and address his, or introduce his latest book, which was at the time An Eye for an Eye.
Which is an amazing book. I was reading that today and taking some notes, and oh my goodness. Oh
yes,
my goodness. What a.
Yeah, but we had problems
book.
when John Sachs started his address. He said, "I believe in the Holocaust."
Right.
Individuals, they were saying, you know, what on earth is this fellow doing here?
Right.
And of course, my argument then was, look, we're an international conference. We bring in the opposition.
Sure.
And we did. Now, in Iran recently, they were confronted with the same thing, because Iran is moving off the Holocaust scene, and it's because it's not tenable anymore. It was with the Dr. Ahmadinejad's administration. They pushed it as far as they could, and now the new administration that will be coming in, they'd like to distance themselves from it, under the sad impression, of course, or misguided impression, that this is going to help them.
Right.
Maybe it will. Maybe not. But certainly, the Western world is now, or the Jewish writers are now gloating over this fact, and they're saying, see, now Iran is moving from Holocaust denial to denial of the Holocaust denial. And that's, of course, not the case, because the conference in Tehran in 2006, December, was a review of the Holocaust. It was not a revision of it. People didn't realize that, and these individuals who are now hopping into Iran and saying, see, we're getting somewhere, Ahmadinejad is out, and so on. No, that's not the case. Nothing would have, the conference would not have taken place had the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, had he not sanctioned it. People thought that Ahmadinejad was the boss of Iran, but he's not. He was the president, but they have a supreme council. And they still have the leader principle, the Führer principle, where the supreme leader is the religious person, and he still determines. And the West didn't cotton onto that till, well, much later. Remember when Ahmadinejad came to, was it Princeton? University where, what's his name? Again, I forget his name because I don't want to remember his name. When he was a guest speaker, and the president of the university insulted him. And I mean, you know, in any society in the world, nowhere should a guest be insulted.
Absolutely.
And that was the first time I ever saw that. Bollinger, I think was his name. And I was quite astounded to see how an academic in America, and he used the term, cease this Holocaust denial and so on. I think the clip's still on YouTube. It's just amazing that someone who should know better treated his host that way. And I mean, Ahmadina Judd is also an academic. And
right.
There should at least have been some basic
civil.
Respect.
No? Absolutely. Even people you disagree with, you should be civil.
Yes, yes. That's always been my principle. You may disagree, you know, but the old maxim that that this Englishman coined, using Voltaire's words. A lot of people say that, you know, I disagree with what you're saying, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it, that this was Voltaire who formulated it. But it was an Englishman who, in some context, quoted Voltaire and said, this is how Voltaire would have approached the subject. This would have been his attitude. And it's only thanks to Forreston that I know about it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we've got to get back to this being civilized and listening to people. After all, it's only words. What is it?
Of course, of course.
I grew up with this maxim: sticks and stones may
break your bones, but words will never hurt you.
No, and now it's feelings. You know, we're at the stage where if somebody has a hurt feeling, well, that'll cost you.
Right. It's to promote this hate speech agenda that they all have that's going worldwide.
Yeah, it's marvelous. And I think it was Dershowitz who split the free expression into free speech and hate speech.
Mm-hmm.
That split should be brought together again. Hate speech is often a rude speech.
Right.
It's basic manners. If you have basic manners, all this political correctness is essentially basic manners. You've got to be civilized when you disagree. No need to shout someone down. What's this? Rachel Morrow, is it?
I know who you mean. Maddow.
I just got an email I saw that in the context of global warming and all sorts of other things, and she's attacking others as Nazis, fascists, right-wing,
terrible,
and so on. When the ones she's attacking, well, as far as I'm concerned, they're left-wing.
Mm-hmm.
They're going along with the Holocaust line.
Sure. And I think it's perfectly fine to have another opinion. And that you should, I feel that I respect everyone. And I respect everyone's right to have an opinion about something. And it doesn't have to be an opinion that I share. I still respect them as people. And I'm certainly not going to get angry if somebody doesn't believe the same as I do. It's just not worth it.
Yeah, it's sad because You're upsetting yourself. We come back to my example of this meeting, the judge who jailed me.
Right.
Why should I feel anger towards him? He was only carrying out orders. He didn't have to. He could have suspended the sentence, but that would have impeded his personal,
credibility or standing or something.
Yeah,
it's amazing what motivates people, but you've taken the higher ground.
Well, the higher or lower, it's the more developed, I would say.
Yes.
I try not to think in high and low. We're all in this process together, this lifelong process. And, you know, 70 and then, as the Germans would say, der Ofen ist aus. The oven is extinguished. The patience is at when I was arrested in Germany, Mr. Moore, he was the detective, he was going on and on, and I said, look, you are just like the Stasi, you're like the DDR, the German Democratic Republic, you're like the East Germans. And he said, he waved his finger at me, he said, that is an insult to a public servant, which is a crime. And, and I knew by that time, I knew I'd lost it all. I'd be locked up. And I whacked his finger. He shook it at me, and I whacked it, and I said, and you waving your fingers and a threat? And he was stomped off in an insult, and then I could hear him going to superior. He said, der Ofen ist aus, die Geduld ist zu Ende. He's putting on a show. You know, the oven's extinguished. Patience is at an end. He's putting on the show, and so on. But he tried to get me to confess that I was a sinner, that I was believing in rubbish, that I was lying about the Holocaust, and so on. And I said, no, look. And even in my first appearance in court, the prosecutor, Klein, was listening to me as the judge made notes of what transpired. You know, in Germany, you don't have a court record like in the Anglo world. Certainly in Australia, there's a professional service now that records every word said in court, the transcript of proceedings.
Right.
Now, where they don't have that in Germany, the judge fiddles with the record and writes it up the way he likes it. And he wrote up what I said that sounded right. And then I said, please add, this is in 99 in April. I said, yeah, long time ago now, we've got May. And I said, please add this comment. If we find the evidence, the physical evidence of the gas chambers, we'll be the first to publish it.
Ah.
We'll be the first to write about it. We are not going to not publish it, because this is what we're looking for. That's our endeavor. Show us, draw us the gas chamber. If the Holocaust believers can bring up that physical evidence, we'll run with it. We're not going to deny it. But to date, it has not been done. And Klein jumped up out of his chair and said, no, no, we don't need that comment on there. We don't need that. I said, yes, please. And the judge said, oh, well, is it relevant?
And yeah.
And I said, of course it's relevant. And he said, oh, well, and Klein was jumping out again and said, no, no, it has no relevance to the matter here. And then I said, no, this is the physical matter. This is the physical aspect of our argument. We rest our so-called official narrative of the Holocaust on the physical evidence, not only of what people say happened. We want to find the murder weapon. And he said, I don't think it's relevant. I said, I insist, Justice, he was a magistrate, please put it in. And so he put it in.
Good for you.
But I never received a copy of this document. I don't know, by now it would have been disappeared.
Sure.
But that's how they do it with the Holocaust legislation in Germany, or with anyone before the court. The other thing, it's essentially the group that handles these, and Mannheim is the center. It's a branch of road traffic offenses. In other words, that's the level at which it operates, because it does not really need a great theoretical discourse to prove anyone guilty, because there is no defence.
Right.
And this element is coming through in Australia under the Racial Discrimination Act, where you have the Section 18D, anything that is liable to offend, insult, and so on, is comes under 18D, Section 18D, and is an offence. And therefore, anyone can come up and say, oh, look, I'm so hurt. This is how my matter started. This Jewish fellow in Sydney was so hurt by what he read. And, you know, usually if you're mature enough, you switch off.
Right. If you don't like what you're reading, then don't read it. Hello? Makes sense. Just don't look at this newspaper. Don't read that book. Don't go watch his TV program. There's a lot of other channels, a lot of other things to read.
Yeah. And that's why I was a little disappointed with revisionists when in 1994 Schindler's List came out and there was a cry to boycott. And I said, forget it. Don't boycott. Just don't go to it. Refute it and let it go.
Exactly.
And this is why I'm contentious here, but I am against the Israeli boycott that's going on at the moment, because it's like the way they're boycotting us. It can backfire.
Mm-hmm.
Once you start boycotting, you are silencing the critics. But, I mean, and there are individuals who are supporting this, academics who are agreeing with it. It's fatal for our academic world to have a boycott of anything. And I think I had that example of the Treblinka case, Caroline Sturdy Coles. Her thesis on Treblinka has been embargoed since 2017. Now, you do not embargo a thesis, because the essence of writing a thesis is collecting the latest information and producing new knowledge. In my case, I wrote my thesis on Karl Popper's theory of fallibilism and Charles Saunders Peirce's principle of fallibilism and Popper's theory of theory falsification. And Peirce, of course, very few people know. He's an American. And he actually developed the logical form of abduction, which in essence is theory formulation. And thereby solving that Hume problem, how do you get from the particular to the general? In other words, how do you get from the physical world to the mental world?
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote, and one contribution was, and Popper didn't like that much, he claimed he did not read Peirce in the 30s when he was formulating these things. And I, in some ways, proved that Peirce had developed his theory in much more detail, also because he had developed a logical system that explained how falsification worked. And so I liken this then to this Sturdy Coles thesis, and also, of course, to the Joel Hayward thesis that was embargoed for 5 years. You know, this is where I then just say, you know, what's going on in academia?
Mm-hmm.
And by the academics boycotting Israel because of the Zionist state's crimes against the Palestinians is a wrong move. What they should focus on, and this is the problem, of course, they won't do, is on the Holocaust. No, the West holds onto it. For example, Deanna, last week, I think it was, a New South Wales state parliamentarian, David Shoebridge, he had a very good speech in Parliament, in state Parliament, against those parliamentarians who the Australian Israel Friendship Society sent to Israel to look at the situation. These parliamentarians were fed Israeli propaganda. Now, Shoebridge didn't go, but he also in Parliament then, in depth, depicted the horrors that Palestinians are living under. I liked that talk. I wrote to him, and I was advised the talk's on the internet. We got it. Peter Harton got it ready for the newsletter on Adelaide Institute and so on. And then I said, well, this is excellent. I hope you don't bend to Jewish pressure. And the reply that came back was, never.
Good.
Then I got an invitation to attend Palestinian solidarity trip around Sydney Harbour, starting at 6 till 9 p.m. at night on the Friday night, I think it was the 1st or 2nd of May. And I paid for my flight up there to Sydney from Adelaide. I hadn't paid my $80 to $100 costs. And so I wrote back and said, look, I've got booked my flights, but can I pay the money when I get there? And they said, we have done a sorry, you are disinvited.
Oh, my word.
You are disinvited because your presence would upset some guests.
Oh, too bad.
So I wrote back and said, why would this be the case? And then they responded by putting Wikipedia's entry and Adelaide Institute, the website.
Oh, my goodness.
In other words, my views on this. So you can see there is this Anthony Lowenstein or Loewenstein,
right.
Lionstone. He's an Australian. His parents were Holocaust survivors. This fellow he's Jewish, and he is one of the big voices in the Palestine movement in Australia. But whenever he sees me, he runs off. At one meeting that he addressed, I came late or afterwards, and I said, oh, hello, Anthony. And I extended my hand. He said, I don't shake Holocaust deniers' hands. So this fellow is now one of the big voices. He self-mutilates. He has earrings all over the place. I don't think he's got a nose earring yet, but in any case, he self-mutilates, which tells me something about his psychological state of mind. He is now one of the big boys, and the Friends of Palestine in Australia shy away whenever we come up. Peter Hartung and others attended a meeting in Adelaide, and they weren't liked. Their presence wasn't appreciated, especially in asking questions. So I worry when I see that kind of development. And only recently. So the Greenies are also falling into the trap of going against the so-called Zionist regime, but not against the Jews and others who push the Holocaust lie.
Right. Do you think that they are trying to control the Palestinian movement, or do you think they are active in it so that they can control the rhetoric about it, maybe minimize it, because that's what they do. They control both sides. They don't want anybody to talk about the Holocaust, but it's okay to talk about the Israelis and their abuse of the Palestinians. It seems like they ought to be talking about both things. If there really was a Holocaust, then why are the Israelis doing the exact same thing to the Palestinians?
Yeah, this is what's happened. They will most likely give up Israel. The Jews will give up Israel because it's not a tenable thing anymore, and they will move back wasn't it Helen Thomas said they've got to go back home, back to Germany,
Germany
and Poland.
I had her on my program one day. she's quite the lady.
But I worry about her. Why, at that old age, does she come out with that statement Why didn't she come out earlier?
I have wondered that also. I don't know. There certainly was opportunity, and she's certainly always always favored her ethnic background. Why didn't she say something earlier? I don't know.
Yeah, but then again, it's an example of opportunism.
Sure.
Of staying there, but if that is a fact, we can be assured that there are many people, and I know from the fact that this is the case, who are in the background. They can't afford to come out because it would be the financial and also the professional death of individuals. This is where Germa Rudolph, he has a lot of contacts with the academic world, where they're in Germany, where there is dissent, but they can't afford to. And so I fully agree with individuals like that coming through as anonymous. Certainly, I agree with that. And it's imperative that these people are there.
Right.
But one wonders whether, and Judge Wilhelm Stäglich, he's the judge, he's passed away now, but he was the German judge who wrote the Auschwitz myth in the 70s, 71, he wrote a little paper that turned into a book in 77, and the IHR published it, and Grabert Verlag in Germany. It was, again, at that time, it was a nightly job. They got the book printed, then sent it off, and of course, I think the next day or the day after, the police were already there to confiscate it. But Stäglich, and just as an aside, he had in the 50s, he got his doctorate from the University of Göttingen. And then in 83, he had this doctorate revoked because the Auschwitz myth, the book, was considered non-academic.
My goodness gracious.
So you can see the signal was sent to the academic world in 83, don't touch the Holocaust.
Right.
Stäglich then said, at that time they didn't have the specific Holocaust law. They used a defamation law, very much like our Racial Discrimination Act, which is a watered-down version of a defamation law, where you have no defense. Truth is no defense, which it is in defamation. So Stäglich said to me, I met him in 97, that if there are 100 judges who refuse to do the bidding, then the law breaks down. But you won't find them in Germany. We had this case, and it links up with this, when a nationalist movement arose in Australia, the Hanson movement. Pauline Hanson was then eliminated through a legal move, and five male judges refused to take it on in the Queensland courts. Then one lady judge, who was Jewish, I believe, I haven't gone into it as such, but she took it on, and of course Hanson was found guilty, and then later on the thing was quashed, but still the job was done on her. And this is what people are frightened of, that there are enough compliant judges who do the politicians' biddings.
And of course, you have generations of a foundation of a politically correct foundation, even though they haven't called it that. I mean, even before the Civil War in this country, the Jews were writing to Congress people and saying, "Hey, you know, you have to, you cannot be talking about people of my ethnicity or people of my religion." And they started that back when they created the B'nai B'rith in 1843. And so you have all of these generations of not being able to talk about a certain group of people, and it is so embedded in our culture, in our society, that people just say they self-censor.
Yes, yes. And it gets lifted into the so-called politically correct or the polite society where you hush, hush, or don't mention the Jews.
Right.
We have this example in Australia. One fellow, he used to never mention the Jew name, but what he did, he talked about the Turks.
Well, it's okay to talk about the Turks. It's okay to talk about the Germans. It's okay to talk about and denigrate just about any other group, but you dare not do the same thing. Even if it's justifiable, you dare not do the same thing regarding the Jews.
Yeah, and that's pathetic. That's, as you said, pathetic self-censorship. Because
yes.
By censoring ourselves like that, I also remember before Tom Schieffer, he was the Australian, the American ambassador to Australia, and before he left off, there was a function I attended, and I asked him, you know, what's going to happen to America? There are people who are working hard to get rid of the First Amendment. He says, it will never happen. He said, if it does, it'll be the end of America.
It's already happened. We're already silencing ourselves as well as not having representation in the media. So, I don't know.
That was a few years back where it wasn't so obvious. 9/11 had happened, but at that time there were still individuals who were quite strong about it, and I mean, at that time, I asked the question because before that I saw a Jew on ABC television in Australia who blatantly stated they're working to get rid of the First Amendment, openly stating it.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you indicated at the beginning, oh, goodness me, it's nearly 2 hours.
It's almost time for you to eat lunch, and it's almost time for me to go to bed.
I think so. Yes, you said you're any good after. What is it? After 10 o'clock, you're not any good anymore.
Well, actually, that period starts at about 9 p.m., and then by 10 o'clock, then I'm totally a zombie.
Yes. Well, you're not the only one. This is called maturity.
Well, it's a function of the fact that I get up so early. I get up really early, about 5 o'clock, and by late evening, I'm ready to go to bed.
Yeah.
Well, early evening, actually.
Yeah. Well, that means you're not watching television.
No, I don't do that anyway.
Why don't you watch television? Let me ask you that. Let me interview you.
Well, for one thing, it's like why would I sit around and watch people get paid for what they're doing? Why would I sit down and watch a football game? I'm actually watching people work when I could be working or doing something productive myself. Why would I watch other people work?
Yeah, that's a new slant. Why don't you want to work and just play lazy and drink your drink?
It's such a waste of time.
Aha. Now, this is almost the German Drang to Arbeit. Arbeit macht frei. You are,
yes.
By actually working, you are therefore not embracing the slave mentality of watching and waiting for someone to tell you what to do,
right.
But you're initiating.
Right. Yeah, I have too many important things to do than to sit and waste time watching others getting paid for what they're doing and not doing it very well.
So why don't you want to be the victim of life?
because that's just not my position that I would embrace.
Indeed, indeed. And there we're getting back to the very, very basics of life. There are some who do and some who don't. And those who do have an impulse wanting to do and are convinced of what they're doing is good, is good for the general community. This is how I see the Holocaust people, the Holocaust revisionists. They know that they are liberating individuals from a massive lie that is crippling the mindsets of the spiritual, the soul of people, because where, you know, truth is a liberating element. It is, I always call it, it's our godly duty to liberate individuals from lies that drag you down, that destroy you, that make you a victim kind of person, where you say everything that comes your way is not of your doing, and you're suffering, and instead you up and go. Bertrand Russell gave the example of the dialectic process. I wouldn't go entirely with it, but it's a very good analogy. There are two people. They get up in the morning. One person thinks dialectically, and the other one doesn't. The one who doesn't think dialectically, he just jumps out of bed, gets dressed, has his breakfast, and is off to work. The dialectically, fully, only dialectically thinking person lies in bed, thinks about getting up, left foot first, right foot first. What am I going to do now? So while the one who thinks dialectically, he or she is still in bed thinking about getting up, the other one's already working. And this means we have a number of different thinking approaches. We can't only just rest on the dialectic of things, because if we don't accept the premise of an argument, then the whole superstructure is rubbish. And then we have to split that dialectic into the Marxist Talmudic dialectic and the Hegelian. But then there are other thinking or intuitive thinking mechanisms that, as I explained, the fellow who just gets up out of bed gets going. You don't have to think about every detail. This leads to a kind of spiritual death, where you have the holy man sitting on a rock and breathing and does nothing but breathe, and the village ladies bring food to him, and they think he's a holy man. Mm. So when then these women, they feed him, and they think, oh, they're doing such a wonderful job feeding this man. And the beauty is, and let me be blunt, when a woman reaches her change of life, then she becomes realistic, and she doesn't take that nonsense anymore. When a man wants to pretend that he's still the guru, she'll say, he has to wake up again and say, well, he can't go on deceiving her in that way any further.
Right.
And then we know who rules the roost.
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Well, it has been lovely chatting with you. We'll have to do this again.
Well, we'll have to see whether, I don't know whether I'm getting into the cliche thinking and repeating myself, but no doubt within the next few months, we'll see something happen in Australia. I hope not, but it may happen.
Oh, I hope not.
Right, Diana.
Yes.
Thank you very much, and goodbye.
Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon. And you can say good night to me. It's never goodbye.
I shall say yes. Good night and night.
All righty. Bye-bye. Thank you so much.
Good night.
Good night.